Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Thrilling Tales, Seattle Public Library's story time for grown-ups. Ordinarily, Thrilling Tales happens the first and third Monday of every month. This October, however, we have a Thrilling Tale every Monday in honor of the season and all the great scary stories that I would be sad about not getting the chance to tell you if I only got to do this twice. So come join us, and please do share, spread the word. Today's stories will also be podcast, so if you know somebody who can't make it or if you'd like to listen to them on a dark night at home, these should appear in a week or two on the library's website. My name is David. I'm a librarian here. I work on the third floor in the Reader Services Department. We've got lots of good books up there. We'd love to see you. And without any further ado, let's get started. Today we have two stories, one from the 1920s and one from the 1820s. In fact, I believe it's the oldest story ever shared here, so it does have some kind of fancy old-timey language, but that's the one we'll start with. And it's a story you may be familiar with even if you've never heard it in this form. Let's see. It's called The Adventure of the German Student, by Washington Irving. In a stormy night, in the tempestuous times of the French Revolution, a young German was returning to his lodgings at a late hour across the old parts of Paris. The lightning gleamed, and the loud claps of thunder rattled through the lofty, narrow streets. But I should first tell you something about this young German. Gottfried Wolfgang was a young man of good family. He had studied for some time at Göttingen, but being of a visionary and enthusiastic character, he had wandered into those wild and speculative doctrines which have so often bewildered German students. His secluded life, his intense application, and the singular nature of his studies had an effect on both mind and body. His health was impaired, his imagination diseased. He had been indulging in fanciful speculations on spiritual essences until, like Swedenborg, he had an ideal world of his own around him. He took up a notion, I do not know from what cause, that there was an evil influence hanging over him, an evil genius or spirit seeking to ensnare him and ensure his perdition. Such an idea, working on his melancholy temperament, produced the most gloomy effects. He became haggard and desponding. His friends discovered the mental malady preying upon him and determined that the best cure was a change of scene. He was sent, therefore, to finish his studies amidst the splendors and gaieties of Paris. Wolfgang arrived at Paris at the breaking out of the revolution. The popular delirium at first caught his enthusiastic mind, and he was captivated by the political and philosophical theories of the day. But the scenes of blood which followed shocked his sensitive nature, disgusted him with society and the world, and made him more than ever a recluse. He shut himself up in a solitary apartment in the Pays Latin, the quarter of students. There, in a gloomy street not far from the monastic walls of the Sorbonne, he spent hours all together in the great libraries of Paris, those catacombs of departed authors, rummaging around their hoards of dusty and obsolete works in quest of food for his unhealthy appetite. He was, in a manner, a literary ghoul, feeding in the charnel house of decayed literature. Wolfgang, though solitary and recluse, was of an ardent temperament. But for a time it operated merely upon his imagination. He was too shy and ignorant of the world to make any advances to the fair. But he was a passionate admirer of female beauty, and in his lonely chamber would often lose himself in reveries on forms and faces which he had seen, and his fancy would deck out images of loveliness far surpassing the reality. While his mind was in this excited and sublimated state, a dream produced an extraordinary effect upon him. It was of a female face of transcendent beauty. So strong was the impression made that he dreamt of it again and again. It haunted his thoughts by day, his slumbers by night. In fine, he became passionately enamored of this shadow of a dream. This lasted so long that it became one of those fixed ideas which haunt the minds of melancholy men and are at times mistaken for madness. Such was Gottfried Wolfgang. And such his situation at the time I mentioned. He was returning home late one stormy night through some of the old and gloomy streets of the Marais, the ancient part of Paris. The loud claps of thunder rattled among the high houses of the narrow streets. He came to the Place de Grève, the square where public executions are performed. The lightning quivered about the pinnacles of the ancient Hotel de Ville and shed flickering gleams over the open space in front. As Wolfgang was crossing the square, he shrank back in horror at finding himself close by the guillotine. It was the height of the Reign of Terror, when this dreadful instrument of death stood ever ready. Its scaffold was continually running with the blood of the virtuous and the brave. It had that very day been actively employed in the work of carnage. And there it stood in grim array amidst a silent and sleeping city, waiting for fresh victims. Wolfgang's heart sickened within him, and he was turning, shuddering from the horrible engine, when he beheld a shadowy form, cowering, as it were, at the foot of the steps which led up to the scaffold. A succession of vivid flashes of lightning revealed it more distinctly. It was a female figure, dressed in black. She was seated on one of the lower steps of the scaffold, leaning forward, her face hid in her lap, and her long, disheveled tresses hanging to the ground, streaming with the rain which fell in torrents. Wolfgang paused. There was something awful in this solitary monument of woe. The female had the appearance of being above the common order. He knew the times to be full of vicissitude, and that many a fair head which had once been pillowed on down now wandered houseless. Perhaps this was some poor mourner whom the dreadful axe had rendered desolate, and who sat here heartbroken on the strand of existence from which all that was dear to her had been launched into eternity. He approached and addressed her in the accents of sympathy. She raised her head and gazed wildly at him. What was his astonishment at beholding, by the bright glare of the lightning, the very face which had haunted him in his dreams? It was pale and disconsolate, but ravishingly beautiful. Trembling with violent and conflicting emotions, Wolfgang again accosted her. He spoke something of her being exposed at such an hour of the night and to the fury of such a storm, and offered to conduct her to her friends. She pointed to the guillotine with a gesture of dreadful signification. "I have no friend on earth," said she.
"But you have a home," said Wolfgang.
"Yes, in the grave." The heart of the student melted at the words. "If a stranger dare make offer," said he, "without danger of being misunderstood, I would offer my humble dwelling as a shelter, myself as a devoted friend. I am friendless myself in Paris and a stranger in the land, but if my life could be of service, it is at your disposal and should be sacrificed before harm or indignity should come to you." There was an honest earnestness in the young man's manner that had its effect. His foreign accent, too, was in his favor. It showed him not to be a hackneyed inhabitant of Paris. Indeed, there is an eloquence in true enthusiasm that is not to be doubted. The homeless stranger confided herself implicitly to the protection of the student. He supported her faltering steps across the Pont Neuf, and by the place where the statue of Henri IV had been overthrown by the populace. The storm had abated, and the thunder rumbled at a distance. All Paris was quiet. That great volcano of human passion slumbered for a while to gather fresh strength for the next day's eruption. The student conducted his charge through the ancient streets of the Pays Latin and by the dusky walls of the Sorbonne to the great dingy hotel which he inhabited. The old portress who admitted him stared with surprise at the unusual sight of the melancholy Wolfgang with a female companion. On entering his apartment, the student for the first time blushed at the scantiness and indifference of his dwelling. He had but one chamber, an old-fashioned saloon, heavily carved and fantastically furnished with the remains of former magnificence, for it was one of those hotels in the quarter of the Luxembourg Palace which had once belonged to nobility. It was lumbered with books and papers and all the usual apparatus of a student, and his bed stood in a recess at one end. When lights were brought and Wolfgang had a better opportunity of contemplating the stranger, he was more than ever intoxicated by her beauty. Her face was pale, but of a dazzling fairness, set off by a profusion of raven hair that hung clustering about it. Her eyes were large and brilliant, with a singular expression approaching almost to wildness. As far as her black dress permitted her shape to be seen, it was of perfect symmetry. Her whole appearance was highly striking. Though she was dressed in the simplest style, the only thing approaching to an ornament which she wore was a broad black band round her neck, clasped by diamonds. The perplexity now commenced with the student how to dispose of the helpless being thus thrown upon his protection. He thought of abandoning his chamber to her and seeking shelter for himself elsewhere. Still, he was so fascinated by her charms. There seemed to be such a spell upon his thoughts and senses that he could not tear himself from her presence. Her manner, too, was singular and unaccountable. She spoke no more of the guillotine. Her grief had abated. The attentions of the student had first won her confidence and then, apparently, her heart. She was evidently an enthusiast like himself, and enthusiasts soon understand each other. In the infatuation of the moment, Wolfgang avowed his passion for her. He told her the story of his mysterious dream and how she had possessed his heart before he had even seen her. She was strangely affected by his recital and acknowledged to have felt an impulse towards him, equally unaccountable. It was time for wild theory and wild actions. Old prejudices and superstitions were done away. Everything was under the sway of the goddess of reason. Among the old rubbish of old times, the forms and ceremonies of marriage began to be considered superfluous bonds for honorable minds. Social compacts were the vogue. Wolfgang was too much of a theorist not to be tainted by the liberal doctrines of the day. "Why should we separate?" said he. "Our hearts are united. In the eye of reason and honor, we are as one. What need is there of sordid forms to bind high souls together?" The stranger listened with emotion. She had evidently received illumination at the same school. "You have no home or family," continued he. "Let me be everything to you, and rather let us be everything to one another. If form is necessary, form shall be observed. There is my hand. I pledge myself to you forever." "Forever?" said the stranger solemnly. "Forever," repeated Wolfgang. The stranger clasped the hand extended to her. "Then I am yours," murmured she, and sank upon his bosom. The next morning, the student left his bride sleeping and sallied forth at an early hour to seek more spacious apartments suitable to the change in his situation. When he returned, he found the stranger lying with her head hanging over the bed and one arm thrown over it. He spoke to her, but received no reply. He advanced to awaken her from her uneasy posture. On taking her hand, it was cold. There was no pulsation. Her face was pallid and ghastly. In a word, she was a corpse. Horrified and frantic, he alarmed the house. A scene of confusion ensued. The police were summoned. As the officer of police entered the room, he started back on beholding the corpse.
Great heaven, cried he. How did this woman come here?
Do you know anything about her? Said Wolfgang eagerly.
Do I? Exclaimed the officer. She was guillotined yesterday.
He stepped forward, undid the black collar round the neck of the corpse, and the head rolled to the floor. The student burst into a frenzy. The fiend has gained possession of me, shrieked he. I am lost forever. They tried to soothe him, but in vain. He was possessed with a frightful belief that an evil spirit had reanimated the dead body to ensnare him. He went distracted and died in a madhouse. So, the version of that story I remember that she told around the campfire, she warns him not to remove the thing from around her neck, right? And then he's the one who removes it. And as her head rolls to the floor, she says, I told you you'd be sorry. You remember that? Okay. That's the same story. Okay. Move forward one century for our main story today, a story by a completely unknown writer who wrote for the pulps by the name of M.L. Humphreys. And the name of the story is The Floor Above. September 17th, 1922. I sat down to breakfast this morning with a good appetite. The heat seemed over and a cool wind blew in from my garden where chrysanthemums were already budding. The sunshine streamed into the room and fell pleasantly on Mrs. O'Brien's broad face as she brought in the eggs and coffee. For a supposedly lonely old bachelor, the world seemed to me a pretty good place. I was buttering my third set of waffles when the housekeeper again appeared, this time with the mail. I glanced carelessly at the three or four letters beside my plate, and one of them bore a strangely familiar handwriting. I gazed at it a minute and then was seized with a beating heart. Tears almost came to my eyes. There was no doubt about it. It was Arthur Barker's handwriting, shaky and changed, to be sure. But 10 years had passed since I've seen Arthur, or rather, since his mysterious disappearance. For 10 years, I've not had a word from him. His people know no more than I what has become of him, and long ago we gave him up for dead. He vanished without leaving a trace behind him. It seemed to me, too, that with him vanished the last shreds of my youth. For Arthur was my dearest friend in that happy time. We were boon companions and made many a mad prank played together. And now, after 10 years' silence, Arthur was writing to me. The envelope was postmarked Baltimore. Almost reluctantly, for I feared what it might contain, I passed my finger under the flap and I opened it. It held a single sheet of paper torn from a pad, but it was Arthur's writing. Dear Tom, old man, can you run down to see me for a few days? I'm afraid I'm in a bad way. Arthur. And scrawled across the bottom was the address, 536 North Marathon Street. I've often visited Baltimore, but I cannot recall a street of that name. Of course, I shall go, but what a strange letter. After 10 years, there's something almost uncanny about it. I shall go tomorrow evening. I cannot possibly get off before then. September 18th. I'm leaving tonight. Mrs. O'Brien has packed my two suitcases and everything is in readiness for my departure. 10 minutes ago, I handed her the keys and she went off tearfully. She's been sniffling all day and I've been perplexed, for a curious thing occurred this morning. It was about Arthur's letter. Yesterday, when I'd finished reading it, I took it to my desk and I placed it in a small compartment together with other personal papers. I remember distinctly that it was on top with a lavender card from my sister directly underneath. This morning I went to get it. It was gone. There was the lavender card exactly where I'd seen it, but Arthur's letter was completely disappeared. I turned everything upside down and then I called Mrs. O'Brien and we both searched, but in vain. And Mrs. O'Brien, in spite of all I could say, took it upon herself to feel that I suspected her. But what could have become of it? Fortunately, I remember the address. September 19th. I have arrived. I have seen Arthur. Even now he is in the next room, and I am supposed to be preparing for bed, but something tells me I shall not sleep a wink this night. I'm strangely wrought up, although there is not the shadow of an excuse for my excitement. I should be rejoicing to have found my friend again, and yet... I reached Baltimore this morning at 11 o'clock. The day was warm and beautiful, and I loitered outside the station a few minutes before calling a taxi. The driver seemed well acquainted with the street I gave him, and we rolled off across the bridge. As I drew near my destination, I began to feel anxious and afraid, but the ride lasted longer than I expected. Marathon Street seemed to be located in the suburbs of the city. At last, we turned into a dusty street, paved only in patches and lined with linden and aspen trees. The fallen leaves crunched beneath the tires. The September sun beat down with a white intensity. The taxi drew up before a house in the middle of the block that boasted not more than 6 dwellings. On each side of the house was a vacant lot, and it was set far back at the end of a long, narrow yard crowded with trees. I paid the driver, opened the gate, and went in. The trees were so thick that not until I was halfway up the path did I get a good view of the house. It was 3 stories high, built of brick, in fairly good repair, but lonely and deserted-looking. The blinds were closed in all the windows with the exception of 2, one on the first and one on the second floor. Not a sign of life anywhere, not a cat or a milk bottle to break the monotony of leaves that carpeted the porch. But, overcoming my feeling of uneasiness, I resolutely set my suitcases on the porch, caught at the old-fashioned bell, gave an energetic jerk. A startling peal jangled through the silence. I waited, but there was no answer. After a minute, I rang again, and then... from the interior, I heard a queer dragging sound, as if someone were coming slowly down the hall. The knob was turned and the door opened, and I saw before me an old woman, wrinkled, withered, and filmy-eyed, who leaned on a crutch. "Does Mr. Barker live here?" I asked. She nodded, staring at me in a curious way, but made no move to invite me in. "Well, I've come to see him," I said. "I'm a friend of his. He sent for me." At that, she drew slightly aside. "He's upstairs," said she, in a cracked voice that was little more than a whisper. "I can't show you up. Hadn't been upstairs in 10 years. "That's all right," I replied, and seizing my suitcases, I strode down the long hall. "At the head of the steps," came the whispering voice behind me, "the door at the end of the hall." I climbed the cold, dark stairway, passed along the short hall at the top, and stood before a closed door. I knocked. "Come in." It was Arthur's voice, and yet not his. I opened the door and I saw Arthur sitting on a couch, his shoulders hunched over, his eyes raised to mine. After all, 10 years had not changed him so much. As I remembered him, he was of medium height, inclined to be stout and ruddy-faced with keen gray eyes. He was still stout, but had lost his color and his eyes had dulled. "And where have you been all this time?" I demanded, after the first greetings were over. "Here," he answered. "In this house?" "Yes." "But why didn't you let us hear from you?" He seemed to be making an effort to speak. What did it matter? I didn't suppose anyone cared. Perhaps it was my imagination, but I could not get rid of the thought that Arthur's pale eyes, fixed tenaciously upon my face, were trying to tell me something, something quite different from what his lips said. I felt chilled. Although the blinds were open, the room was almost darkened by the branches of the trees that pressed against the window. Arthur had not given me his hand. It seemed troubled to know how to make me welcome. Yet of one thing I was certain, he needed me, and he wanted me to know he needed me. As I took a chair, I glanced about the room. It was a typical lodging house room, medium-sized, with flowered wallpaper, worn matting, nondescript rugs, a washstand in one corner, a chiffonier in the other, a table in the center, 2 or 3 chairs, and the couch, which evidently served Arthur as a bed. It was cold, strangely cold for such a warm day. Arthur's eyes had wandered uneasily to my suitcases. He made an effort to drag himself to his feet. "Your room is back there," he said, with a motion of his thumb. "Oh, no, wait," I protested. "Let's talk about yourself first. What's wrong?" "I've been sick." "Haven't you a doctor? If not, I'll get one." At this, he started up with the first sign of animation that he showed. "No, Tom, don't do it. Doctors can't help me now. Besides, I hate them. I'm afraid of them." His voice trailed away, and I took pity on his agitation. I decided to let the questions of doctors drop for the moment. "As you say," I assented carelessly. Without more ado, I followed him into my room, which adjoined his and was furnished in much the same fashion. But there were two windows, one on each side, looking out on the vacant lots. Consequently, there was more light, for which I was thankful. In a far corner, I noticed a door, heavily bolted. "There's one more room," said Arthur, as I deposited my belongings, "one that you'll like, but we'll have to go through the bathroom." Groping our way through the musty bathroom, in which a tiny jet of gas was flickering, we stepped into a large, almost luxurious chamber. It was a library, well furnished, carpeted, and surrounded by shelves fairly bulging with books. But for the chilliness and bad light, it was perfect. As I moved about, Arthur followed me with his eyes. "There are some rare works on botany." I'd already discovered them, a set of books that I would have given much to own. I could not contain my joy. "You won't be so bored browsing around in here." In spite of my preoccupation, I pricked up my ears. In that monotonous voice, there was no sympathy with my joy. It was cold and tired. When I'd satisfied my curiosity, we returned to the front room, and Arthur flung himself, or rather fell, onto the couch. It was nearly 5 o'clock and quite dark. As I lighted the gas, I heard a sound below as of somebody thumping on the wall. "Oh, that's the old woman," Arthur explained. "She cooks my meals, but she's too lame to bring them up." He made a feeble attempt at rising, but I saw he was worn out. "Don't stir," I warned him. I'll bring up your food tonight." To my surprise, I found the dinner appetizing and well-cooked. And in spite of the fact that I did not like the looks of the old woman, I ate with relish. Arthur barely touched a few spoonfuls of soup to his lips and absently crumbled some bread in his plate. Directly I had carried off the dishes, he wrapped his reddish-brown dressing gown about him, stretched out at full length on the couch, and asked me to turn out the gas. When I had complied with his request, I again heard his weak voice asking if I had everything I needed. "Everything," I assured him, and then there was unbroken silence. I went to my room, finally, closed the door, and here I am, sitting restlessly between the two back windows that look out on the vacant lots. I've unpacked my clothes and turned down the bed, but I cannot make up my mind to retire. The truth be told, I hate to put out the light. There's something disturbing in the way the dry leaves tap on the panes. And my heart is sad when I think of Arthur. I found my old friend, but he's no longer my old friend. Why does he fix his pale eyes so strangely on my face? What does he wish to tell me? Well, these are morbid thoughts. I will put them out of my head. I'll go to bed, get a good night's rest, and tomorrow I will wake up finding everything as right as it should be. September 26. I've been here a week today, and have settled down to this queer existence as if I had never known another. The day after my arrival, I discovered that the third volume of the botanical series was done in Latin, which I've set myself the task of translating. It is absorbing work, and when I've buried myself in one of the deep chairs by the library table, the hours fly fast. For health's sake, I force myself to walk a few miles every day. I've tried to prevail on Arthur to do likewise, but he, who used to be so active, now refuses to budge from the house. No wonder he's literally blue, for it is a fact, his complexion and the shadows about his eyes and temples are decidedly blue. What does he do with himself all day? Whenever I enter his room, he's lying on the couch, a book beside him which he never reads. He does not seem to suffer pain, for he never complains. After several ineffectual attempts to get medical aid for him, I have given up mentioning the subject of a doctor. I feel that his trouble is more mental than physical. September 28th, a rainy day. It's been coming down in floods since dawn, and I got a queer turn this afternoon. As I could not get out for my walk, I spent the morning staging a general house cleaning. It was time. Dust and dirt everywhere. The bathroom, which has no window and is lighted by gas, was fairly overrun with water bugs and roaches. Of course, I did not penetrate to Arthur's room, but I heard no sound from him as I swept and dusted. I made a good dinner, and I settled down in the library, feeling quite cozy. The rain came down steadily, and it had grown so cold I decided to make a fire later on. But once I had gathered my tablets and my notebooks about me, I forgot the cold. I remember I was on the subject of the Aster trifolium, a rare variety seldom found in this country. And turning a page, I came upon a specimen of this very variety, dried, pressed flat, and pasted to the margin, and above it, in Arthur's handwriting, I read, September 27th, 1912. I was bending close to examine it when I felt a vague fear. It seemed to me that someone was in the room and was watching me, yet I'd not heard the door open nor seen anyone enter. I turned sharply and I saw Arthur, wrapped in his reddish-brown dressing gown, standing at my very elbow. He was smiling for the first time since my arrival. And his dull eyes were bright. But I did not like that smile. In spite of myself, I jerked away from it. He pointed at the aster. It grew in the front yard, under a linden tree. I found it yesterday. Yesterday? I shouted, my nerves on edge. Good Lord, man, look, it was 10 years ago. The smile faded from his face. 10 years ago, he repeated thickly. 10 years ago? 5 o'clock. Dusk is falling. Oh, God, what has come over me? Am I the same man that went out of this house 3 hours ago? And what has happened? I had a splendid walk. I was striding homeward in a fine glow. But as I turned the corner and I came inside of the house, it was as if I looked on death itself. I could hardly drag myself up the stairs, and when I peered into the shadowy chamber and saw the man hunched up on the couch with his eyes fixed intently on my face, I could have screamed like a woman. I wanted to fly, to rush out into the clear, cold air and run, to run and never come back. But I controlled myself. I forced my feet to carry me to my room. There is a weight of hopelessness at my heart. The darkness is advancing, swallowing up everything. But I have not the will to light the gas. Now there's a flicker in the front room. I'm a fool. I must pull myself together. Arthur is lighting up, and downstairs I can hear the thumping that announces dinner. It's a queer thought that comes to me now, but it's odd that I've not noticed it before. We're about to sit down to our evening meal. Arthur will eat practically nothing, for he has no appetite. Yet he remains stout. It cannot be healthy fat, but even at that, it seems to me that a man who eats as little as he does would have become a living skeleton. October 5th. Positively, I must see a doctor about myself, or I shall be a nervous wreck. I am acting like a child. Last night, I lost all control and played the coward. I've gone to bed early, tired out from a hard day's work. It was raining again, and as I lay in bed, I watched the little rivulets trickling down the panes. Lulled by the sighing of the wind among the leaves, I fell asleep. I awoke, how long afterward I cannot say, to feel a cold hand upon my arm. For a moment I lay, paralyzed with terror. I would have cried aloud, but I had no voice. At last I managed to sit up to shake the hand off. I reached for the matches and lighted the gas. It was Arthur who stood by my bed. Arthur, wrapped in his eternal reddish-brown dressing gown. He was excited. His blue face had a yellow tinge, and his eyes gleamed in the light. "Listen," he whispered. I listened, but I heard nothing. "Don't you hear it?" he gasped as he pointed upward. "Upstairs," I stammered. "Is there somebody upstairs?" I strained my ears, and at last I fancied I could hear a fugitive sound like the light tapping of footsteps. "It must be somebody walking around up there," I suggested. "No," he cried in a sharp, rasping voice. "No, it is nobody walking about up there." And he fled to his room. For a long time I lay trembling, afraid to move. But at last, fearing for Arthur, I got up and I crept to his door. He was lying on the couch and his face in the moonlight, apparently asleep. October 6. I had a talk with Arthur today. Yesterday I could not bring myself to speak of the previous night's happening, but all this nonsense must be cleared away. We were in the library, a fire was burning in the grate, and Arthur had his feet on the fender. Slippers he wears are as objectionable to me as his dressing gown. They're felt slippers, old and worn and frayed around the edges as if they'd been gnawed by rats. I cannot imagine why he does not get a new pair. "Say, old man," I began abruptly, "do you own this house?" He nodded. "Do you rent any of it?" "Downstairs to Mrs. Harlan." "But upstairs?" He hesitated and then shook his head. "No, it's inconvenient. There's only a peculiar way upstairs." I was struck by this. "Oh, by Jove, you're right. Where is the staircase?" He looked me full in the eyes. "Don't you remember seeing a bolted door in a corner of your room? The staircase runs from that door." I did remember it, and somehow the memory made me uncomfortable. I said no more and decided not to refer to what had happened that night. It occurred to me that Arthur might have been walking in his sleep. October 8th. When I went for my walk on Tuesday, I dropped by and saw Dr. Lorraine, who's an old friend. He expressed some surprise at my run-down condition, and he wrote me a prescription. I'm planning to go home next week. How pleasant it will be to walk in my garden and listen to Mrs. O'Brien singing in the kitchen. October 9th. Perhaps I better postpone my trip. I casually mentioned it to Arthur this morning. He was lying relaxed on the sofa, but when I spoke of leaving, he sat up as straight as a bolt. His eyes fairly blazed. "No, Tom, don't go." There was terror in his voice, and such pleading that it wrung my heart. "You've stood it alone here for 10 years, I protested, "and now?" "It's not that," he said, "but if you go, you will never come back." "Is that all the faith you have in me?" "I've got faith, Tom, but if you go, you'll never come back." I decided that I must humor the vagaries of a sick man. "All right," I agreed, "I'll not go. Anyway, not for some time." October 12th. What is it that hangs over this house like a cloud? For I can no longer deny that there is something. Something indescribably oppressive. It seems to pervade the whole neighborhood. Are all the houses on this block vacant? If not, why do I never see children playing in the street? Why are passers-by so rare? And why, when from the front window I do catch a glimpse of one, is he hastening away as fast as possible? I'm feeling blue again. I know that I need a change, and this morning I told Arthur, definitely, that I was going. And to my surprise, he made no objection. In fact, he murmured a word of assent and smiled. He smiled as he smiled in the library that morning when he pointed at the Aster trifolium. I don't like that smile. Anyway, it is settled. I shall go next week, Thursday, the 19th. October 13th. I had a strange dream last night. Or was it a dream? It was so vivid. All day long, I have been seeing it over and over again. In my dream, I thought that I was lying there in my bed. The moon was shining brightly into the room so that each piece of furniture stood out distinctly. The bureau is so placed that when I'm lying on my back with my head high on the pillow, I can see full in the mirror. I thought I was lying in this manner and staring in the mirror, and in this way I saw the bolted door in the far corner of the room. I tried to keep my mind off it to think of something else, but it drew my eyes like a magnet. And it seemed to me that someone was in the room, a vague figure that I could not recognize. It approached the door and caught at the bolts. It dragged at them and struggled, but in vain. They would not give way. Then it turned and showed me its agonized face. It was Arthur. I recognized his reddish-brown dressing gown. I sat up in bed and I cried to him, but he was gone. I ran to his room, and there he was, stretched out in the moonlight, asleep. It must have been a dream. October 15th. We're having Indian summer weather now, almost oppressively warm. I've been wandering about all day, unable to settle down to anything. This morning I felt so lonesome that when I took the breakfast dishes down, I tried to strike up a conversation with Mrs. Harlan. Hitherto I found her as solemn and uncommunicative as the Sphinx, but as she took the tray from my hands, her wrinkles broke into the semblance of a smile. Positively, at that moment, it seemed to me she resembled Arthur. Has she also something to tell me? Don't you get lonesome here? I asked her sympathetically. She shook her head. No, sir. I'm used to it now. I couldn't stand it anywhere else. And do you expect to go on living here the rest of your life? Well, that may not be very long, sir, she said and smiled again. Her words were simple enough, but the way she looked at me when she uttered them seemed to give them a double meaning. She hobbled away, and I went upstairs and wrote Mrs. O'Brien to expect me early on the morning of the 19th. October 18th, 10 a.m. I'm catching the 12 o'clock train tonight. Thank God. I had the resolution to get away. I believe another week of this life would drive me mad, and perhaps Arthur is right. Perhaps I shall never come back. I asked myself if I become such a weakling as that to desert him when he needs me most. I don't know. I don't even recognize myself any longer. Oh, of course, I will be back. There is the translation, for the one thing, which is coming along famously. I could never forgive myself for dropping it at its most vital point. As for Arthur, when I return, I intend to give in to him no longer. I will make myself master here and cure him against his will. Fresh air, a change of scene, a good doctor, these are the things he needs. But what is his malady? Is it the influence of this house that has fallen on him like a blight? One might imagine so, since it is having the same effect on me. Yes, I have reached the point where I no longer sleep. At night I lie awake and I try to keep my eyes off the mirror across the room, but in the end I always find myself staring into it, watching the door with the heavy bolts. I long to rise from the bed and draw back the bolts, but I'm afraid. How slowly the day goes by. The night will never come. 9 p.m. I've packed my suitcases and put the room in order. Arthur must be asleep. I'm afraid of parting from him. It will be painful. I shall leave here at 11 o'clock in order to give myself plenty of time. It's beginning to rain. October 19th. At last it has come. I am mad. I knew it. I felt it creeping on me all the time. Have I not lived in this house a month? Have I not seen? To have seen what I have seen, to have lived for a month as I have lived, one must be mad. It was 10 o'clock. I was waiting impatiently for the last hour to pass. I had seated myself in a rocking chair by the bed, my suitcases beside me, my back to the mirror. The rain no longer fell. I must have dozed off. But all at once I was wide awake, my heart beating furiously. Something had touched me. I leapt to my feet, and as I turned sharply, my eyes fell upon the mirror. In it, I saw the door, just as I'd seen it the other night, and the figure fumbling with the bolt. I wheeled around, but there was nothing there. I told myself that I was dreaming again, that Arthur was asleep in his bed, but I trembled as I opened the door of his room and peered in. The room was empty. The bed not even crumpled. Lighting a match, I groped my way through the bathroom into the library. The moon had come from under a cloud and was pouring in a silvery flood through the windows, and Arthur was not there. I stumbled back into my room. The moon was there, too, and the door in the corner was half open. The bolt had been drawn. In the darkness, I could just make out a flight of steps that wound upward. I could no longer hesitate. Striking another match, I climbed the back stairway. When I reached the top, I found myself in total darkness, for the blinds were tightly closed. Realizing that the room was probably a duplicate of the one below, I felt along the wall until I came to the gas jet. For a moment, the flame flickered and then burned bright and clear. Oh, God. What was it I saw? A table, thick with dust, and something wrapped in a reddish-brown dressing gown that sat with its elbows propped upon it. How long had it been sitting there, that it had grown more dry than the dust upon the table? For how many thousands of days and nights had the flesh rotted from that grinning skull? In its bony fingers, it still clutched a pencil. And in front of it lay a sheet of scratched paper, yellow with age. With trembling fingers, I brushed away the dust. It was dated October 12th, 1912. It read, "Dear Tom, old man, can you run down to see me for a few days? I'm afraid I'm in a bad way." See you next week.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.